Napoleonic podcast listeners, today on the podcast we have a podcast exclusive for you. Anyone I think who's maybe on Napoleonic Twitter will be familiar with the musings of a Twitter handle called at Bubbles the Vampire. Well, Bubbles the Vampire is here with me tonight, and I'm delighted to be able to welcome Bubbles here. Charles McKay, let me ask you, what's the deal with your Twitter handle?
Yes. I do get asked this a fair bit. So I have two sons, and when my oldest son was, 10, 11 years old or so, he was making a Dungeons & Dragons adventure for his friends. And he came to me and said, "Dad, I have a vampire and I need a name for it, but I don't want the name to be too scary." So I said, "Well, why don't you call him Bubbles?" So then he became Bubbles the Vampire, and that sort of took on a persona. And, you know, fast forward all these years, voila, as the French would say, and here we are with the vampire.
Well, that's brilliant. Well, that was not quite the proper introduction to which you perhaps deserved. So, but Charles McKay, it's great to have you on the podcast. And, you know, we've just been talking about goings on in Egypt and Syria in 1799, and there's so much to talk about off the back of that. But I think one thing to mention right at the start here is that, of course, your PhD, your doctorate was on Andros Juno. That's right, the not quite Marshall, but such an important thing. Not quite. He didn't make it. So definitely keen on asking you one or two questions about him and his relationship with Napoleon. So we can dive in. But after that somewhat silly introduction, I think the first proper serious question would be to ask how you came about, you know, looking into such an interesting life as Juno, as the roulette wheel of your Napoleonic studies, as the ball bounced, it landed in the Juno slot. So how did that happen?
Well, there's a long story and there's a short story. The short story is, when I got to graduate school at Florida State, Don Horver was my supervisor. I was 22 years old by like 2.5 weeks. And he set me down and he said, "You're going to write a dissertation on Andros Juno."
Right.
All right. Well, that's what I'll do. So that's the short version. The longer version is that I was always sort of fascinated with, we had talked, I have a Scottish background. Both of my grandparents are from Scotland. And I remember when I was a little boy, my parents had an American heritage history book. And one of the paintings in that is the famous British assault up breach at Bunker Hill. And the famous painting there of, you know, you're looking down the British lines and there's, you know, equipment strewn around and these guys are all bandaged from, you know, previous attempts and whatnot. And, you know, I was just fascinated, mystified by how these guys would walk shoulder to shoulder up this hill only to get machine gunned, because I was 7 or 8 years old.
Right.
By
right.
Colonials, not really understanding that, of course, nobody had automatic weapons at this point. But it fixed my interest in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And initially, I was interested in maybe doing a Scottish topic. So, you know, you sort of look around and where are the Scots? I didn't want to do any like clan feuds or anything like that. And so, you know, where are the Scots busy fighting? Short answer is everywhere. But particularly, they were in the Napoleonic Wars. So I spent a lot of time reading in the Peninsular War. And so when I had contacted Don Horward and said I was interested in maybe doing a Peninsular topic, he said, "Can you read French?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Okay, you're going to do a dissertation on Andros Juno."
Wow, that's fantastic. And the Scottish link is really interesting as well, because, yeah, you're right. The Scottish are all over the place in this period.
Indeed. In fact, I lived for a bit in Brunswick, Georgia, which is near St. Simon's Island. It's in the southeast part of Georgia on the coast. But the next little town above it, Darien, was actually founded by Scottish immigrants in the 1730s. And they had a remarkable existence there. One of the brothers got eaten by an alligator. I mean, this is like tough existence out here. But again, you know, the pioneers – first ones there fighting the Spanish, you know, so they're everywhere all the time.
So that's, yes, absolutely. Very impressive indeed. And actually, just to mention Don Howard, who Alex Micabridze has talked about enormously fondly as well. Don Howard died recently, or, you know, in the last few years. And he leaves quite, I think it's fair to say from everything that I've heard Alex say about him, that he leaves a big hole.
Indeed. He was prolific. There were probably, I forget the number, but close to 60 PhD graduates from Don Howard, and I think nearly twice as many master's students. He didn't have children of his own, and in a sense regarded us at different stages as, you know, all of his children. He had a warmth every time you would see him at conferences and things. He would greet us all warmly. I miss him.
Yeah, that's really good. And yeah, clearly a fantastic legacy that he's left. Well, let's hear about Juno then, because you know, there's lots of different ways we could dig into this, but I think there's something about something odd about the relationship between Napoleon Bonaparte and Juno that you sort of get hints of when you're sort of, you know, reading histories, and you sort of raise your eyebrows. And Juno is an odd character in that sense, that he's, because he's there all over the place, all the way through. But it's almost like it's not just his relationship with Napoleon Bonaparte. He's close to Bonaparte the man, but also an important figure in the Napoleonic soap opera, perhaps we might say as well.
Yes, aided in fact by his wife, who Laura Juno, the Duchess of Brabantes, who has volumes and volumes and volumes of scandalous memoirs. She in fact, after the Empire scratched out a living cranking out these memoirs, supported financially by Balzac and by Victor Hugo, and she ultimately was not that fond of Napoleon. So her memoirs are always a little suspect.
Yeah.
There's been a creative license taken there on occasion, and sometimes parsing out fact from fiction is a little bit of a challenge. But Juno himself had a big personality, so this adds to it.
Okay, let's give us, why don't you give us and the listeners a quick taster of the sort of top three Juno scandals that will shock you.
Well, let me set the table a little bit by talking about how Juno and Napoleon got acquainted, because I think that might make some of this make some more sense. So the two meet each other at Toulon. And Juno, and this is just a little sidebar here, he was renowned for his excellent penmanship. And until you go into an archive, you have no idea what a blessing that is.
You landed on your feet there.
Oh, my goodness. He was a fantastic, yes. He has a beautiful script. And in fact, there's a fun story that Napoleon and Juno are essentially in a sheltered area. An enemy shell hits close enough that it throws dirt onto a message that Juno is inscribing. And Juno looks at Napoleon and says, "Well, now I won't need sand to dry the ink."
Yeah, that's good. That's funny, isn't it? Yeah, they've got a good thing going here.
Yeah, attaches his personal allegiance to Napoleon. And then I think the real super bonding happens in that period in Paris during the Revolution, when Napoleon refuses to go to the Vendée and instead, you know, picks up his toys and goes home and is unemployed and just hanging out, existing in Paris. It's Juno, Marmont, and Napoleon who are all sharing an apartment. And that getting the money from Juno's dad, who's a functionary back in Côte d'Or, but also they're extending that a little bit. Juno was a decent gambler, and he especially liked blackjack. And so they would, you know, stretch that, you know, meager pittance that Juno's father would send them into the three of them you know, getting enough food and wine to, you know, make it to the next day.
Yeah, Three Amigos, getting it through, and through a ropey, tricky period as well. And presumably this was the sort of emotional capital built up that was to stand Juno in good stead when he started pushing his luck with Bonaparte a bit later on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so at that point, Juno, you know, becomes Napoleon's aide, and the two of them are at this period inseparable. You know, Juno goes to the first Italian campaign. He goes to Egypt, although during that first Italian campaign, he's sent back to Paris with enemy standards and, you know, gold and loot and paintings and things, and then accompanies the Napoleon's new wife, you know, Josephine, down to the front. But Josephine has also brought along Hippolyte Charles.
Oh, not Hippolyte Charles.
her boy toy. Right. And so, as you know, sees a lot of extracurricular activities going on there. Not that he was paying too much attention, because apparently he was doing some of his own stuff, which got loud enough that Josephine complained. So,
right. This is, So, but there's not too much subtlety on display from any of these characters here. Okay.
And subtlety was certainly not a characteristic of Juno, but collecting head wounds was, and unfortunately he had a pretty good one at Longwy in early 1793, and then he got a pretty serious saber wound to the skull at in Italy during the first Italian campaign. And this would sort of mark he collected a lot of head wounds, and it probably affected his overall health and also some of his judgment. But I think more seriously, it introduced him to opium and amped up by alcohol.
Yeah.
And we're going to see a period of sustained abuse of both opium and alcohol throughout his career.
Okay, I was just going to ask, when did that peak? Was there a particular time when you think it had a particular influence?
At Desano in 1796 was pretty intense. Yeah. Madame Juno talks about an incident where Napoleon, pulling a prank, walks up behind Juno's ponytailed hair and gives it a tug and withdraws his hand, and it's covered in blood. So I don't know how well that wound healed, but obviously to deal with that, there's a lot of self-medicating that's going on there for Juno.
Yeah, but he's still got so much to come in his career after the 1790s. You know, he continues and on with mixed success, but you know, he's very much a part of the story all the way up to the final years.
I think his chief. Well, I know his chief, the element that he had for Napoleon was he was unquestioningly loyal. And he had no political ambition. I mean, zero.
Yeah. Which is very, very helpful. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So when we get to 1800, he is made the governor of Paris. Primarily because, I mean, he is devoid of any political ambition whatsoever and blindly loyal to Napoleon. So he loves playing the role in hosting parties and dignitaries. And he ran up just astronomical debts on, you know, mansions and costumes. And he enjoyed dressing every bit as flamboyantly as Murat. Not quite as well. Nobody could do it as well as that. But, you know, he enjoyed dressing up. He enjoyed fine things, wine and books. In particular, so he spent lavishly during that time. But Napoleon kept him in that place because, again, he's just devoid of any political interest whatsoever. So disinterested in politics that he probably should have done a better job as the governor of Paris, looking over the police and maintaining things. So when the army goes off to Boulogne, for instance, he does not go off to Boulogne. He is still in Paris, tending shop while Napoleon spent a lot of time in Paris as well. But when the campaigns start, often Juno's left in Paris.
Well, this is one of the maybe you mentioned before we started recording the dichotomies in the relationship. You have this very trusted person who's right at the sort of, you know, the inner circle of trust for Napoleon. And he's so trusted that he's not in the inner circle so much because he can be sort of left alone for large parts of the story. So we see that in Egypt, but then later on as well.
Sure. And you know, I think he was a very capable cavalry colonel, but I don't know at that point beyond that rank. He doesn't have the natural talent of Lannes, or certainly of Murat or Davout or any of the marshals, the initial crop. I mean, he's not even in that league. And frankly, Marmont had more going on than Junot did. But Junot had that unfailing loyalty. And I think Napoleon often used him as, you know, if legislatures create legislation that's not ever going anywhere, but it's a message bill. Junot was like a message candidate. So, for instance, in 1804, Napoleon sends Marshal Lannes to the court of Lisbon to be the ambassador. Now, that's rich. Lannes is a peasant.
Right.
Sending a peasant to the court of the Braganzas. I mean, this shows you the level of disrespect that Napoleon had for the Portuguese. Now, when it looks like things are heating up, he needs Lannes back. So Lannes gets recalled, and who gets sent? Junot replaces Lannes. So what a message to send. You're sending one of the emperor's closest associates. You know, what kind of message does that deliver to the Braganzas, or perhaps the British or the Spanish, that, you know, somebody so close to the imperial family would be sent to be an ambassador?
Yeah, that's an interesting switch. And of course, Junot wasn't the only French general to lose to Wellington in the Peninsula. But unlike them, perhaps one of his greatest achievements was the deal he got in being shipped back to France with the Convention of Cintra, which was that one of his biggest achievements in a way? He turned defeat into, you know, not such a bad settling up.
and ironically, he had very little to do with it. He showed up at the battlefield at Vimiero at 7:30 in the morning, drunk out of his mind. The French get smashed at that battle. And Junot leaves that battle in an open carriage with the wives of two of his officers who are wounded on the field at that moment to head back to Lisbon. So, you know, we don't have a quality individual in the 21st century term. I think his real success at Cintra was sending his cavalry commander, Kellerman, the son of the marshal, to do the initial treating. Now, what's so genius about this, and I don't even know that we give credit to Junot for thinking about it, Kellerman had spent several years in the United States as a French diplomat to the United States. So Kellerman knew English.
Yes.
So when they go to treat, they parlay en français, right? Because that's the diplomatic language. And Kellerman didn't volunteer that he knew English. So when Berard, Dalrymple, and Wellesley go into the next room, and they have a heated argument because Wellesley's like, no, we got these guys. Let's drive them into the sea. You know, Berard and Dalrymple are not of the same mind, and you know they're stating why, and so, you know, Kellerman's listening to all of this. He knows exactly where the soft spots are for the British, and then when they come back, he just turns the screws that, you know, he knows Dalrymple is going to freak out about. So he gets this deal that's just, I mean, it's unreal. I mean, the French get everything. They get to go home. They get their cannons, their guns, their colors. They get all their loot.
It's outrageous.
I mean, they land, and immediately Napoleon says, well, you brought everything back, so back to Spain you go. And I mean, they land, and they go right back to Spain.
It was completely mad. But from Junot's point of view, excellent delegating to get Kellerman out there. Clearly, that's what we can chalk up for him.
Blessed with a number of good. That first army, Thibault was his chief of staff, who was fantastic. I've already talked about Kellerman. Delaborde, who was his first divisional commander, who held off the English at Reliefa, had a fantastic career, eventually ending up in the guard General Foy was there, Clausel, Sonniac. I mean, he had a fantastic Loison, even though he's reviled in Portugal. I mean, these are all seasoned and officers who had fantastic careers in the French Empire. So Junot got lucky with a great, great staff and a great cast of characters to make up with his failings.
Now, luck. This is you mentioned in one of the segments that we recorded the theme of luck, and you've mentioned it again there as something that seems to matter. I mean, whether it's Napoleon's luck or the luck of those around him, there's something about in this period which does seem to get people, you know. Nelson was very lucky in surviving all those battles until he suddenly stopped being lucky, but I wanted to ask you more about that. So let's hear a little bit more about your sense, having looked at Junot in particular, about the role of luck and what that plays in this period.
Yeah, and I think for him, the luck really was managing to stay alive for as long as he did. You know, he gets shot in the peninsula in the face. In fact, Wellesley offers to send his own surgeon over. I cannot recall all the times that he got shot, wounded, mostly in the head. And so we all remember Oudinot and how many times he got, you know, dinged up. But Junot had to be a close second. And most of those, you know, are blows to the head. So, you know, between those repeated blows to the head and the abuse of the opium and the alcohol, his performance really does decline. His judgment is just not good. I think maybe the best example of his poor judgment might have been in 1807. So Napoleon and the Grand Armée are off in Poland trying to bring the Russians to bear. And so Junot is back in Paris as the governor of Paris. And Caroline, you know, Napoleon's sister, cooks up this plot, you know, to maybe overthrow the government in case of Napoleon's demise, and seduces Junot, who's married himself at this point. And of course, Junot, I falls right for it. I mean, it just, you could not imagine anyone being more naive and falling for something like this. But I mean, it's well publicized. It's a scandal in Paris. Everybody knows what's going on. Junot's wife knows what's going on. Napoleon, of course, finds out what's going on after he, you know, scores that decisive defeat at Friedland, comes back to Paris. And, you know, you figure, okay, there's going to be some reckoning here, right? I mean, there's going to be some hell to pay. Not only is Napoleon back, Murat is back. Murat doesn't say anything about it, and Napoleon says, dude, what the hell are you thinking? You got to get out of town. I'm going to put you in command of an army. I'm going to send you to Portugal.
And off he goes, yeah. Whereas in other circumstances, you know, it might have ended quite badly for Junot there.
Oh, indeed, yes. But instead, he gets sent off, and the whispers are, you know, if he can somehow manage to capture the Portuguese fleet in this process, that maybe he'll be made a marshal. So imagine that. You have an affair with the emperor's sister who's trying to overthrow the government, and your reward is you get put in front of an army that could go to Portugal, you know, capture a navy, and give yourself a baton.
And he came pretty close to getting those Portuguese dollar bills, didn't he?
Napoleon wanted him in Lisbon by 1 December. 30 November, the elements of the 70th line stumble into Lisbon looking like absolute ragamuffins. But there'd been a contrary wind, and so the Portuguese royal family, everything is basically stuck in Lisbon until, you know, literally the French are on the outskirts of town. And apparently the fleet escorted by the British was so close to the shore still that operating the shore guns, they had an opportunity to hit. I mean, they were still within range.
No way.
You know, you're not going to compel a fleet to come back at that point. So.
Well, yeah, I'd get another example of the fortune of war.
Indeed. Had the wind stayed contrary just a little bit longer, then it's very possible that the French could have captured the Portuguese fleet. And that would have been a different story. But not only that, I mean, imagine how different the story would have been for Latin America.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. This is
Portuguese history at that point. I just had a Twitter discussion with this. There's almost nobody doing any work on Portugal from like 1808 until, 1818, somewhere there, because all of the focus becomes what the Portuguese end up doing in Brazil.
Yeah, this is the contingencies of history on which so much turns. One more question on Juno. Just coming back to your PhD, okay, you've got this extraordinary life, and a man who was a complex personality in the middle of this, raging psychodrama of a situation. What exactly? I haven't come across your thesis, but how did you turn all of this into academic gold dust?
Well, he's obviously at so many important points. He's in the first invasion of Portugal where Wellesley defeats him. He's at the siege of Saragossa in 1809. He has a corps protecting the rear of the Grand Armée in 1809. He invades Russia. So he's at important parts all along. It's not like I could avoid him in the narrative of the broader picture of what's going on in the First Empire. But I've always been interested in, you ask a historian what they do and they say, well, I read dead people's mail. it's because we're all intensely interested in people and how people react and how they face adversity and whether they succeed or fail or how colossally they fail. And in the process of getting into Juno, he ends up being a complicated character. I think if he were alive today, I'm not, and always psychohistory is a dangerous area, and I don't necessarily want to go there and dwell there. But I could see a diagnosis of manic depression for him, bipolar disorder, because there were periods of real manic activity and dare I say it, competence. You don't get to command a corps in the French army if you don't know how to get soldiers to a field and
flashes of brilliance.
Yeah, well, maybe. I'm a little
bit together, but okay, maybe that's pushing luck a bit. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. but there were some real, real notable failures, and I think the biggest one, and it's kind of where everything dovetails, is in Russia. Because Napoleon calls him out by name for having failed to cut off the Russian retreat at Smolensk. And again, the contemporary accounts, Junot's drunk, the battle's raging. It would not take a seasoned Napoleon, a corps commander, long to see, okay, if I advance, I'm going to cut off the Russian retreat. And in fact, Murat even rides over to Junot and says, dude, march. All you got to do, you march your corps there, and we're going to have the Russian army. And Junot dithers and says, I don't have orders, and the ground is swampy, and I'm drunk, and so he doesn't. And Napoleon blames him for that defeat in the dispatches, and that just shattered Junot psychologically.
Oh, yeah.
Now, he performs well at Borodino, but he's left behind. Specifically, Napoleon tells him, I'm leaving you behind on the battlefield of Borodino to clean up the mess, to punish you for Smolensk.
Ouch.
So the Grand Armée goes off to Moscow, right? So they can party and have a good time and revel in whatever success they think that is. And Junot has got a field of tens of thousands of dead Russians, French, Poles, Germans, Italians, all over, and the horses.
Yes.
Yeah, that has to clean that up.
And of course, when the retreat does take place, the battlefield has not been cleaned up particularly.
I don't know who among us has experience cleaning up a battlefield of tens of thousands of dead. I don't know how long that takes. But no, he was not in top form. He was spending most of his time writing these just absolutely heartbreaking, heart-wrenching letters to his wife about how he's lost the favor of the emperor and he doesn't know what he's going to do. I mean, he sounds almost suicidal without saying he's suicidal. you know, he's begging his wife to write to Napoleon to give him a second chance. And then eventually, you know, poor Eugene, when he's having to, you know, do something with the remnants of the Grand Armée in January of 1813, basically said, hey, what do I do with this Junot guy? And Napoleon writes him and says, you could dismiss the Duke of Abrantes. That is one less encumbrance for the army, and he will be absolutely no use to you.
Wow. So those days spent together with Marmont in, 1795 are a long way off by then, 20 years back. Yeah.
Ironically, there's one twist that ties all that together.
No way.
Is Junot's, relentless attempts to get back into the good graces of the emperor. Napoleon finally relents. Again, if he wants loyalty in 1813, I mean, he's got it in Junot. That's the only thing Junot can offer. But there's nobody that's going to offer it with more earnestness and passion. And so Napoleon says, fine, why don't you go to the Illyrian provinces and you can be the governor there? And, of course, Marmont had just been there. But Napoleon needs Marmont in the field. So Junot goes to the Illyrian provinces. But at that point, untreated syphilis, alcoholism, opioid addiction have just it's game over. So Junot shows up at a town square almost naked. He has his hat, his saber, and his boots on, and he's completely naked otherwise. And then he mounts an equestrian statue and proceeds to bark out orders. At one point, he called out the National Guard because he thought the sheep were conspiring against him.
Got to keep an eye on the sheep. But this is very sad, isn't it? It's a real decline.
State ball in that same sort of, you know, hat, saber, boots, to the terror of the crowd who all scream and ran. And eventually, you know, word gets back to Napoleon and says, geez, we got to get this guy back to, you know, get him some help. Junot is not willing to go willingly. So they literally throw a tobacco sack over his head and cart him out of the Illyrian provinces. So, yeah, and then he was supposed to go to Geneva. They got some wires crossed. His wife was in the midst of miscarrying a baby that wasn't his. He goes to Montbard there in Côte d'Or where his family is. At one point, he looks at his dad and says, did you know I'm a bird and I can fly? And he throws himself out of, you know, what the Americans would call a third story window, second story view, but it's French. So, I mean, this is a stone house with probably a 20, 25 foot drop. Breaks his ankle in the process, yet runs, tries to scale the wall before his dad and his servants can sort of pull him down. The wound gets infected with gangrene. Several days later, his dad comes in and finds him stabbing at the wound with a pair of scissors because Junot's trying to amputate his leg himself, and then he died later on that afternoon. Coda, his death was so important to Napoleon that Savary, the minister of police Savary, himself went into Junot's estate in Paris to collect all of the correspondence and the paperwork. So we did not, you know, little minions were not dispatched to do this. Savary himself went to Junot's Paris townhouse to collect those papers.
And from the point of view of the historian, what happened to those papers? Were you able to access them, or were they all gone?
No, a lot of them were destroyed. I've been able to put some together through the National Archives has a pretty good cache of them in place, but they're not like Junot's papers. You have to go dig for them in different areas. But a lot of the correspondence is not there.
Was there a particular moment when you came across something when you were looking at Junot that the sort of bolt of electricity really rang through you and you thought, oh my gosh, this is such an amazing find?
Maybe not an amazing in the sense that, oh my goodness, I've uncovered some wonderful factoid here that nobody has. But I was constantly amazed at the number of contemporary sources who remarked on his inebriation at really critical moments, like at Vimiero or like at Smolensk, or
so it was more of a head slap then another, oh no, like, not again, Junot.
Right.
Yeah.
But I was also struck, I suppose, by you know, the humanity, you know, the Siege of Saragossa was hard. And it was hard for, well, obviously everybody, but even, you know, the generals who were in command, you know, that the correspondence that Junot shared during 1809, I mean, it got dark, and he had lethargy and he didn't want to go do his, what he was supposed to do. And he just wanted to, you know, lay around at headquarters and he didn't want to be there. And, you know, the French had a succession of commanders at Saragossa because it's grim, grim business. You know, I think if you're a soldier, a professional soldier, nobody really likes ruining churches and slaughtering civilians. And I don't think most of them thought that's not my job. My job is to protect France from Austrians or Russians or Prussians or British or whatever. That was tough.
Yeah. So there's so many difficult moments during this period, so much light and shade in his life and in the period generally as well, I guess, which all makes me feel like this would just be a great TV series. you could start in 1795 and then run all the way through. It'd be great, you know, the circle of all of them. It'd be brilliant.
And I'll get a little real here with you in the sense that, you know, my dissertation is still not published, in part because, I mean, I didn't like him as a person. He's awful most of the time to his wife, and he's really self-absorbed. But
these qualities, these unlikable qualities, are really what makes him so fascinating.
I hadn't turned it into a book, and then I ended up leaving academics because I wanted to pay my bills. And you know, every night I go to bed, you know, here is this monster dissertation.
Oh, it looks cool. It looks good.
And you know, I always said I would get it published before Don Horvath passed, and you know, it's still not published. And I do have a publisher who's interested in it. And you know, I've started the editing process and whatnot. And you know, with age and experience, you know, I'm not 25 anymore. When it was 30 years ago, so I've gotten some perspective, and it's allowed me to kind of make peace with the fact that, all right, this might have been an onerous individual, but you know, even onerous individuals are fun to hang out with on occasion, right? I mean, he's bigger than life. And I mean, the stuff that he does sometimes is just fascinating and interesting and humorous. And
so typical of the period that so much is going on in these lives that it's all a bit over the top, perhaps, but it's all very, very compelling.
It is. And, you know, obviously someone who ends up, you know, he's hooked on alcohol and opium in part because of the wounds and the pain he must have been in nearly all the time. But at the same time, you know, that's a crutch for, you know, folks who may not have the tools to handle whatever they have to face in their everyday lives anyway. And, you know, I can feel some compassion for that. And I'm certainly not going to excuse or explain away anything, but you know, as you get older, you start to realize, okay, people are complicated, they're always grays. And so,
yeah, and so there we are. Well, look, I would say, Charles, that certainly it's what I'm feeling, but I'm sure anyone who's listening to this will be thinking, yeah, let's get this book out and dig into it a little bit more. No, absolutely, you know, because it's these key relationships that Napoleon Bonaparte has with complex personalities. He is right up there. That's definitely what makes this so interesting. You know, it's not impossible that in a few years' time, people might listen to this and then Google it quickly and get it in the post pretty quickly. So we'll keep our fingers crossed.
And we could honestly have a whole separate episode on his wife.
Who is just as
interesting and just as salacious and things. So, but that's probably a topic for another day. I should add, perhaps as the final coda, that Napoleon on Saint Helena, you know, of course, as he's evaluating everything, did write that he realized that Juno was, you know, suffering from some mental decline. Yeah. And he realized that Juno was not up to top form in Russia. And, you know, he basically said, poor Juno, and
forgave him. Yeah.
Right. Would have come to terms with him and that sort of thing. So, you know, but again, I don't think Napoleon ever could have questioned Juno's loyalty. And at the end of the day, when he dies with very, very few people around him, that loyalty must have meant a lot.
Absolutely. That's right. That makes total sense that these bonds, they did survive everything that followed. Wow, that's powerful stuff. Well, I'd be interested as well in, you know, let's get you on the podcast again. And let's do another one on Laura Juno, because we hear a lot about the men, but the women are utterly fascinating. So there's plenty more of that to come. And so, Charles, I think all that's left is to say thank you very much for now. It's been great talking to you.
Yes, thank you. This has been a wonderful romp. I've so enjoyed this, and thank you so much for having me.